How many were familiar with the invocation, O nobly born, you who are the sons and daughters of the awakened ones, the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas? Anybody know that one? Isn't it beautiful? I have particular affection for it because when I first heard it, I thought, I don't really know if that applies to me. O nobly born? That sounded so big. And the more I heard it or would come across it in books or in teachings, I started realizing, oh, that includes me. That includes me. And I could start to experience that sense of how I relate to that teaching, beginning with the posture, which is why I offered you the guidance on really sensing into this beautiful, upright, attentive posture of nobility, of integrity. I did see the question on the poem. That's Mary Oliver. It's called Praying. Okay. I'm not great at paying attention to the chat as I'm giving a talk, so if I don't respond, just know that, and we'll have time at the end, because I don't multitask very well. So I am attentive, but please know that. So, O nobly born, you who are the sons and daughters of the awakened ones, the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas, remember who you are, your luminous mind, the goodness of your heart. Trust it, return to it. It is home. So I first heard that, I think, Jack Kornfield said it at some point in a meditation, but I'm also drawing on some of his work in his book called The Wise Heart, which is the study of the Abhidhamma, which is Buddhist psychology. And there are many different principles of Buddhist psychology. The first one is to see the inner nobility and beauty of all beings, including ourselves. See the inner nobility and beauty of all beings, including ourselves. So today is Juneteenth, and how do we expand our awareness from our own inner nobility truly outward to the nobility of everyone, no matter what? It's a big practice, but I want to bring that in today, that it goes beyond us for sure. So this posture of nobility and dignity and uprightness of mind and body is a presence. It is a willingness. It is this sati that is required, this soft receptivity of mind, which I think is also a soft receptivity of heart, to not distinguish so much between the difference between the mind and the heart, but the mind-heart, the citta. And within that, there's a certain amount of porousness or vulnerability, I think, that we can bring. And the vulnerability is I'm not referring to the vulnerability where it's too hard to take things in. I'm talking about the vulnerability that has a little risk-taking in it, that has a little courage in it, this willingness of presence to show up. And so this sitting with strength, this sitting right here with strength and relaxation at the same time, with this knowing, I belong. I belong. And in fact, on the night of the Buddha's awakening, when he is sitting under the Bodhi tree, and the story goes that he decided after 4 or 5 years of ascetic practices that weren't working to bring him into the deep understanding of suffering and the end of suffering, that he was going to sit there until he figured it out. And the story goes that as he sat there and was assailed by what were known as the armies of Mara, Mara being the trickster, the inner critic, the voice of doubt that says, who do you think you are to be doing this? Why do you think you can study your mind? Why do you think you can understand how suffering works? And finally, after he was assailed, and each time Mara gave him some other challenge, and he, you know, mustered up his courage each time and said, I see you, Mara. I see you, Mara. I'm not afraid. Well, sometimes I think we are afraid, but this practice helps us meet whatever is here, because life can be scary for sure. And then it's said that Finally, he touched the earth with his right hand as he sat there and said, I have a right to be here. We have a right to be here. We all do, every being. And this is this quality of connection, this quality of belonging that is so important for us to keep coming back to, that whatever we notice internally in the meditation might be pleasant, might be unpleasant, to know that whatever is here, there's a way in which it belongs. It's connected to us. Can we not reject any part of ourselves to say this too? And that can be hard work. That can be very hard work. So how this posture, this beautiful dignified posture, then how does it relate to the posture of our lives? It's not just our sitting practice that is the center of our lives. It's what we learn in this sitting practice, I think, that we take out into the world, how we spend our time, how we show up. Here's one of my favorite stories about how we take this inner nobility and bring it into showing up. And it comes from a book called The Vow Powered Life from Jan Chosen Bays. And she's a Zen priest in Oregon. And I can't remember exactly where in Oregon, but she's got a couple of books that I love. This is one of them called The Vow Powered Life, which really looks at what does it mean to make commitment, to show up over and over again. And another book she has that I enjoy very much is called How to Train a Wild Elephant. And it's daily exercises in meditation. In mindfulness, how to show up, how to build awareness. And she has things like, for a day, brush your teeth with your non-dominant hand and see what happens. You're just to bring awareness into how we are. Or can you notice the negative space around things? So instead of looking at the primary object that you're looking at, can you see the space around it? And that's an interesting practice. And you can even do it looking at the Zoom. You know, you can look at the space around each person just for a moment. Just notice what you notice. Another practice that she has around showing up and cultivating mindfulness is noticing the use of filler words when we're speaking. What are those words we use to fill space? We all do it. So, like, you know, whatever they are, but it's just building awareness. So that's a little bit of an anecdote, but here's the story that I love so much. In 1666, the Great Fire destroyed 80% of the homes in London. St. Paul's Cathedral, built in the 11th century over 160 years, was destroyed. The great architect, Christopher Wren, was hired to rebuild the cathedral. Work started in 1669 when Wren was 37 years old, and the first service was held in the church when he was 65. He received the second half of his promised salary at the age of 79 when the church was completed. Who among us would have the vow powerful enough to continue working on a project for 32 years at half salary? There's an interesting story from the time of the rebuilding of St. Paul's. One morning, Wren, who was not personally known by many of the workers, stopped and asked three different laborers, all engaged in the same task, what they were doing. The first said, I'm cutting this stone. And the second answered, I'm earning 3 shillings 6 pence a day. And the third man straightened up, squared his shoulders, and still holding his mallet and chisel, said, I am helping Sir Christopher Wren build this great cathedral. So that is a nobility, a presence, a showing up, a connection, a belonging, a metaphor of thinking about sitting with strength and inner dignity and nobility. I have a right to be here. I'm becoming something bigger than ourselves, on becoming part of something bigger than ourselves, and never losing sight of that, that it's easy to get caught up in our individual lives, of course, of course. And we're so self-referential. But what if we can use our practice regularly and consistently to understand our interconnection? And this is where I want to go as we explore for a little bit longer tonight about what is the connection between our inner experience and our outer experience, this beautiful inner nobility that understands that it's part of something much bigger. It was December of 1968 when Apollo 8 went up into space and took the first pictures of Earth from space. Do you remember that? That beautiful picture that changed so many lives. Earthrise is the name of that photo. And it was a miraculous thing that happened for the astronauts who took the pictures, who saw what the Earth actually looks like from a distance. And it's interesting that discovering Earth from this perspective, it gave rise to the Gaia theory that was formulated in the 1970s after this photo, which proposes that the Earth functions as a self-regulating living system of which we are an integral part, not just beings living on the Earth, using resources, but part of its regulatory system. We are an integral part of this living Earth, part of each other. We are literally part of the Earth. So when we do practices like elements and we come into the awareness of how is this air element coming in and out of us? How do we notice the fire element of heat and cool, the water element, this element that holds things together, and this earth element, our solidity? To understand the exchange of oxygen and carbon dioxide, that we are of everything. Everything is of us. And that what we do, what we think, and how we live our lives truly matters. And I think when we get that, at least what I hope, is that as we are deeper and deeper in our practice, or whether we come and go, however often your practice, whether it's your sitting practice or your sangha practice, your study practice, whatever it is, typically it goes in cycles. And some of us are very, very consistent, and sometimes we just can't be. But however it shows up for you, I think over time, there's a deeper and deeper understanding and connection to this radical interconnectedness that is so true, that everything is connected to everything else. And when I say radical, I don't mean extremist. I mean from the root, complete interconnectedness. And that leads us to the second principle from the Abhidhamma, which says, compassion is our deepest nature. It arises from our interconnection with all things. Compassion is our deepest nature. It arises from our interconnection with all things. Because when we get that, and I don't mean just kind of get it, I mean those moments where you get it with a capital G, you can't unget it, I think compassion naturally arises. It's just what happens. The heart is moved when we realize that what you do affects me and what I do affects you and all of us together. And so in that meditation towards the end, when I offered the guidance of not only sensing your own inner stillness and that sphere around you, how it can hold you, and that we are all doing that together. And how does that space outside of each one of us, even though we are virtual, there's a way in which we are connected and we know it. The energy of the mind and the space, we are doing this together. Pema Chodron, dear Pema, she says, what you do for yourself, any gesture of kindness, any gesture of gentleness, any gesture of honesty and clear seeing towards yourself, will affect how you experience your world. In fact, it will transform how you experience your world. What you do for yourself, you're doing for others, and what you're doing for others, you're doing for yourself. And I think this comes out of the Buddha's teaching that says, by protecting myself, I protect others, and by protecting others, I protect myself. And we can change that language to, by caring for others, I'm caring for myself, and vice versa. Any gesture of kindness towards myself ultimately is a kindness towards you, vice versa. When we understand that we need each other, that we are so completely interconnected. And then it makes us, it sheds light on, I'm going to show up and help Sir Christopher Wren build this great cathedral. If he can do it for 37 years, I can show up too with that quality of presence. Here's another example, a couple more examples of this interconnection. It's a wonderful way to think about it. So we start from thinking about Earthrise from the very biggest outer space view, seeing our Earth. And then we'll come all the way back down into the Earth. This is called the slime mold story. This is how this happens each and every day on this spectacular, magical, and overwhelmingly cooperative planet. Cluster of amoeba competing for space and other resources on a rotting log, each trying to get enough, competing and fighting and breeding. The volume of me for the amoeba is very high. And suddenly, for reasons we do not yet understand, but seems to have something to do with overshooting the carrying capacity of the resource, amoeba reach critical mass and begin to cooperate. Some amoeba becoming responsible for food transport, some responsible for movement, some responsible for excretion. The volume of we becomes very high for the amoeba. And seemingly out of nowhere and literally overnight, these individual beings decide to work together, to share and to become a more evolved type of organism that we call slime mold. If you walk in the redwood forest today, you will inevitably come into physical contact under your feet with hundreds, maybe thousands of these wise teachers. I like to wink at them and bow to them, because they know something that my people very much need to know. So my understanding of slime mold is it's that furry stuff that might grow on dog poop. You ever seen that in the forest? It's just that fuzzy, furry stuff that grows everywhere. That's slime mold. And here's another one of thinking about our interaction with our world. This comes from Mark Coleman's book, Awaken the Wild. While doing standing meditation with my eyes closed in the forest, I noticed a tickle on my face. It traveled repeatedly from my mouth to my right eye and back again, and over a period of about 10 minutes. Practicing non-reactivity, I breathed patiently, sensing many light legs busy walking back and forth. And after some time, a new strange sensation appeared on my mouth, like it was being covered. Curiosity got the best of me and I opened my eyes. A small spider had woven a delicate web over my mouth and secured its gossamer thread on an eyelash. I felt an exquisite intimacy with this being. I felt touched at being considered part of nature, suitable to make a home on. And yet at the same time, I knew I would shatter its home and our intimacy when I opened my mouth. What intimacy, delicacy, and destruction, the touch of grace as delicate as a spider's thread. So our task is to go from me to we, to deepen and strengthen our compassion, our wisdom, our awareness, and to love ourselves and each other and the earth, because we protect what we love. We do. So if we can expand that out, compassion will arise. We will see the inner nobility of all beings. Couple more things I want to talk about with how we can think about our brain and how we embody our practice. There's this fantastic article in the May 22nd, 2018 issue of Mindful Magazine, and it is called The Magnificent, Mysterious, Wild, Connected, and Interconnected Brain. And it was an interview that Barry Boyce, the editor of Mindful Magazine, did with Cliff Sarin and Amish Jha. And Cliff Sarin is a researcher at UC Davis and very strong, deep meditation practice. And Amish Jha is a researcher in Florida. And they were talking about their research and the science of the brain science around mindfulness and just how much we don't know. That is really the bottom line, just how much we don't know. And they were talking about this researcher, his name is Jeff Lightman at Harvard, and he asked his students to consider if knowing everything possible about the brain is a mile, how far have we traveled? If knowing everything possible about the brain is a mile, how far have we traveled? And the answers tended to range from a quarter of a mile to three quarters of a mile. And his answer, 3 inches. 3 inches. That's how much we don't know about this mysterious brain and how this works. But we do know that our practice changes us somehow, whether it's literally changing the brain or shifting our hearts, our mind heart, there's something happening here. So it's important to keep questioning, but it's also important to sit inside this don't know mind. You know, those beautiful teachings that come out of Zen practice that says, always keep don't know mind. Always keep don't know mind. Or Suzuki Roshi's seminal teaching, in the beginner's mind, there are many possibilities, and in the expert's mind, there are few. Can we keep that and just keep showing up? Trusting this unfolding. And then another researcher named Anil Seth, who's a professor at Sussex, and he's been studying neuroscience and physics and virtual reality, mathematics, psychology, all of it. He's come up with what he calls the 4E cognition. And this is about how we integrate internally and externally. So the first E is embodied. And you know, I don't know if you hear about this a lot, but I think that it's very much integrated into our practice for this practice to become embodied, that we really tend to the internal experience and the external experience, that this sati, this open, soft receptivity of mind becomes very available as we cultivate it through the sitting practice. The quality of heart and metta becomes a way of being. It's, you know, turning the thermostat of the heart to warm, this embodied practice, so we show up clear, aware, present. And then embedded, and this is fascinating, that the bodily system is embedded in and connected to and part of an environment. So our internal and external expands. It's embodied and embedded. And then he says it's extended, that the environment extends through time and space, meaning it doesn't have a fixed boundary and it keeps changing. So my experience mixes with your experience and creates something else. The energy, my energy, your energy, how these mirror neurons work, that we pick up on each other's energy when we come into a room. There's so much we don't know about what is going on, but it is interconnected. And then the last E is enactive, which is that we're not passive cognitive processors of a predetermined reality, but we actually enact a reality from the actions we perform. And that is karma, right? That is this interconnection. What we do matters. There's a ripple effect to absolutely everything. Embodied, embedded, extended, and inactive. And I think that when we connect our practice, the literal sitting practice, or whether it's our daily walking around practice, with this quality of integrity, of inner nobility, it is not arrogant at all. It is courageous to show up with our hearts, minds, bodies, present. We see how this all connects together. And then, O nobly born, makes sense. You who are the sons and daughters of the awakened ones, this is a lineage. We are all connected in this. And all these teachers who have come before us matter, and they've influenced us, and we each influence each other. I imagine that there is a tremendous amount of wisdom in this room. I just happen to be in this role tonight. But there's so much here that has been brought forth through everything that's come before for all of us. And we show up and we do this together. And I want to end with this another poem. This is called The Facts of Life from the Irish poet Padraig O'Tuama. The facts of life. That you were born and you will die. That you will sometimes love enough and sometimes not. That you will lie, if only to yourself. That you will get tired. That you will learn most from the situations you did not choose. That there will be some things that move you more than you can say. That you will live. That you must be loved. That you will avoid questions most urgently in need of your attention. That you began as the fusion of a sperm and egg of two people who once were strangers and may well still be. That life isn't fair. That life is sometimes good and sometimes better than good. That life is often not so good. That life is real, and if you can survive it well, survive it well. With love and art and meaning given where meaning's scarce. That you will learn to live with regret, that you will learn to live with respect, that the structures that constrict you may not be permanently constricting, that you'll probably be okay, that you must accept change before you die, but you will die anyway. So you might as well live and you might as well love. You might as well love. You might as well love. So thank you, everybody, for your kind attention. Let's spend some time talking with each other about anything that I said, any questions. We'll just open it up. Yeah. Bill, please.
I was just curious about the Abhidhamma reference. Could you tell me which book and which section? Do you have a citation there?
I do. That came from Jack Kornfield's book, The Wise Heart.
Oh, okay.
And he breaks it into, I don't know how many different principles, but those are the first two that he discusses, to see the inner nobility of all beings. He actually says in the book, all human beings. I took license with it and made it all beings. And the second one is compassion leads us. Let me tell you exactly what it says. Compassion is our deepest nature. It arises from our interconnection with all things.
So I would go to his book to get the actual.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Check that out. Yep. Yep.
All right. Thanks.
Go to The Wise Heart. You're very welcome. What are you thinking about? Yeah, Deborah, please.
First of all, thank you. That was fabulous.
You're very welcome. My pleasure.
Really love it. I mean, love you being here. Love your years of study to teach us these, to bring us these. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Your assiduousness, something I lack lately. But you, given Bill's question, his inquiry, you quoted... a woman? Oh my God. You quoted a woman. You were reading something.
Jan Chosen Bays.
Yes. How do you spell her last name?
Chosen, which I think is her Zen priest name.
Right.
Bays, Bays. She's fabulous. She's a pediatrician. She's done a huge amount of work in trauma and domestic violence with children. Mm. And she's a Zen priest. And I think she's a really beautiful teacher.
What was her book?
The Vow Powered Life.
I've actually heard of that.
Yeah,
so I particularly perked up. So thank you.
You're welcome. Who else? So was there anything that I said that, yes, Barbara, please.
I just want to thank you for the reference to slime mold. It's one of my favorite beings, and I really want to get their awareness pumped out into the world. Slime mold liberation. And if the human beings don't evolve, the slime mold might take over, and that will be good.
She has high hopes for slime mold.
Whatever, despair about everything.
You know, I'm so glad you said that, because I love that piece too. It was a friend of mine who's a botanist who sent that to me years ago. And I treasure that because it's such a beautiful example of the smallest of organisms make such a big difference. We really need them. We really need them. Thank you. Yeah, Deborah. Let's go with Mary and then Deborah.
So I just got back from a retreat.
Uh-huh.
And one of the things that you were talking about was, what I find is there's things that I learn. And at first they kind of sit in this little area.
Yes.
And gradually they come down to the heart and mind. And then they become accessible without me having to think about it.
Yeah.
They just kind of come up naturally. And one of the things you were talking about tonight was the whole idea of don't know mind. And I've mentioned this to people before. I mean, when Philip talked about it over 20 years ago to me, it was nauseating. It's just a horrible thought. It's like, no. No, we want to know. This is not okay. It was just like, you know, it really was a physical
fascinating. Yeah.
And then he'd always talk about the imaginative possible. You know, the imaginative possible. And that's kind of the beginner's mind. And on this retreat, one of the things I realized, it would come up, is that I could, and I have been over the years working with it, is I can actually sit back and don't know mind. And it's actually a place of comfort now. That it's like I don't have to grab. There's no grasping. I don't have to hold on to things.
Yes.
And that when you're sitting with the things like you had talked about, you could just sit in that space. And it is necessary to have that in order to have the imaginative possible. You know, it's like you can't imagine taking the slime wall, you know, teaching us lessons over the world. And it is. Letting go. I think one of the things I find getting older is letting go of some of the fixed things and just allowing the possibilities to come.
It's beautiful, Mary. That's right. So, you know, that the end of the Metta Sutta that says, by not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one is not born again into this world, right? There's so much value in not holding to fixed views because it keeps us so stuck. And there's the freedom when we can say, I don't really know, but I'm going to wait and I'll find out. It doesn't mean not having knowledge or skills.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't mean that at all, but that imaginative process, that not having to have it right, to know it, or the freedom that is available when we don't have to have so many opinions.
Yeah.
You know, what is it like this whole work that Donald does on transforming the judgmental mind that starts with just noticing, oh, there's another one. Oh, there's another one. And not being so loyal to our opinions. It's so much, that's freedom.
Mm-hmm. And what's really lovely is when, for my meditation, it came up a lot. And so now this is a wonderful practice to have it spontaneously come up just in daily life.
Yeah.
And kind of asking myself,
yeah,
how is my view fixed?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Thank you. Thank you. Deborah, were you going to say something? I'm not sure what you mean. Do you want to? Oh, Charlesy. Hi. Nice to see you again.
Oh, hello. Hi. Yeah, thank you for the reference to Earthrise. And it just made me think of, you know, ways of seeing and perspective. And, you know, my generation's Earthrise, I guess, was because I'm in my 40s, was Voyager 1's picture of the Earth, the pale blue dot that Carl
exactly.
Sagan commented on.
Yes.
And, you know, the realization that we're this, you know, when taken in another perspective, we're just a pixel, you know, among billions. And I'm sure, you know, my son's generation will have pictures from, you know, some other thing mm-hmm. that's, you know, mm-hmm. in another galaxy.
Yeah, to your point, I think that in the pale blue dot, Carl Sagan refers to the Earth as a dust mote in a sunbeam. And it is that. We are that small, and how we fight over a corner of a dot, right? The corner of a dot. He goes, if anybody wants to look this up, look up pale blue dot. It's really something. It's a beautiful, beautiful piece on just how small we are and how vast everything is. And yeah, thank you for that. Thank you for that reminder. It's nice to see you again. Thanks for being here. Liz.
I'm just beginning to teach mindfulness with my teeth chattering the whole way. And it is quite a journey. It's an extraordinary journey. And makes you rethink everything about yourself from top to bottom, inside and out. But I've been listening to Jack for many years say, "Oh, nobly born." And I would push that aside, you know, I'm not nobly born. And then I'm listening to what comes up in people's minds as they meditate, all their negative thoughts. I'm not good enough. I'm not smart mm-hmm. enough. And there's a lot of it. And so I'm counteracting that. We brought up working with the emotions and thoughts last week. And no, I am now going to the goodness of our souls, of our hearts, of our desires to be together with each other. And I have a wonderful quote from Pema, which I'll put in the chat. But we are nobly born. There's the 10,000 joys and the 10,000 sorrows and the 10,000 self-criticisms. And the 10,000,
that's right.
You know, it's a container of all of our emotions, jealousy, anger. And yet we are nobly born because we're working with them.
That's right.
We want to work with them.
Because we show up. We show up with exactly who we are. Yeah. And when your teeth chatter, when you are teaching and you feel that teeth chatteriness.
Oh, yeah.
Just letting that, just know you belong. You're offering something really important. And I'll offer you a piece that Sylvia Boorstein gave to me many, many years ago when I was beginning to teach. And she said, just teach what you know.
Oh, yes.
Because if you wait until you know the whole thing, you'll never start teaching.
It'll be a few lifetimes. But
so, you know, just trust what you know. That's what I want to say. Trust where you are.
Thank you. I do. Thank you. And what did Jon Kabat-Zinn call it? Not the whole Megillah, but what was the title of that book?
Oh, The Full Catastrophe Living.
The Full Catastrophe
Living. Right. Not the whole Megillah, The Full Catastrophe. Yeah. Right.
I translated it into New York Jewish.
Same thing.
But it is full catastrophe living. There's so much going on.
There's so much.
A lot of it isn't very beautiful. A lot of it is very beautiful. To accept all that is going on as our birthright.
Yep.
and that we are nobly born is what I'm trying to work with them.
That's beautiful. That's beautiful. I'm glad. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Okay, we have a few minutes left. Who else? This is one of my favorite things to do, is to get to talk with everybody. Wrestle with some stuff.
I just wanted to repeat what both you and Mary said about keeping the mind that doesn't know is a kind of window into a liberation for me.
It is.
Like, I can be triggered and hurt or pissed off, and then I'm thinking, I don't really know.
Yeah.
It's motivating that person, how they grew up. I don't really know.
We don't really ever know what's truly going on inside of another person, but what we do know, we don't know each other's stories, but we can make a pretty accurate bet that we all understand despair, that we all understand loss, and hopefully we all have had joy and beauty. And so that is this second principle, that when we see into the interconnection of all beings, compassion naturally arises and we connect. We see that and feel that connection. We don't have to know the story.
Or the whole story. We could know a shred of it. But like you say, not at all. Just knowing I don't know is, God, it's so liberating. It's wonderful.
It's so liberating.
I also just wanted very briefly to say thank you for talking about Juneteenth. I have a young friend back east. She's a Black woman. She was born here, but her parents were immigrants to this nation, to this country. And she works in ruraler areas, oftentimes in hospitals, taking care, beautiful care of, she's a physical therapist. And she was texting me about the microaggressions. And yeah, I just can't. I mean, I know being Jewish, being from New York, being female, having gone to school where Jews had horns and they were Christ killers, I've done, you know, but I still can't imagine. While you're helping somebody to walk or to get around in their bed, even. Today was pretty powerful for me today around that. So I just wanted to acknowledge that and say thank you for talking about that in the context of interconnection.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah.